In 2022, Team Milk came together by sponsoring female marathon runners for the marathon in New York City. Today, they're more than 20,000 strong. In 2024, Team Milk is making an even bigger commitment to female runners and launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. The inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome to the Long Form Podcast. This is episode 6. I am Evan Ratliff of Atavist, and I'm here with Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer of Long Form.
Hey!
Hey there.
I'm going to do a different kind of hey on every episode.
You shouldn't whistle anymore.
Yeah, that doesn't pick up.
Yeah, that one sounds weird.
This week, Max, actually, earlier this summer, you went to San Francisco and did this interview?
Yeah, I was there in July and called Mac McClelland and went and talked to Mac McClelland, who's the human rights reporter at Mother Jones. And it being July, we didn't quite have our recording game totally together yet. So Max sounds great. I am inaudible at times, but I think, you know,
coming in 2014, we're gonna have a really great sound.
Yeah, one day we'll figure this out.
But it's not a product of it being July, though. It's a product of it having been a time
where
we didn't know how to record
anyone who recorded anything in July was terrible.
It could be true.
It was a black cloud hanging over America.
American podcasting. Anyway, Mac McClelland.
First story I ever wrote, I wrote in my head, and I actually write huge chunks of my features that you would read. I write huge chunks of them in my head for like hours, and then I memorize them, and then I write them out.
Really?
I don't know why I just told you that. But when I was like five years old, I was on a trip in...
Does it take a long time to memorize them?
No, that's automatic.
You just have.
I can memorize like large amounts of stuff in a row. I can memorize probably 3 paragraphs or something, you know, like in a row, and then I just write the sentences out. But so I was doing that when I was 5, walking down a beach, and I was writing this story in my head about this little girl who drowns herself in the ocean, because I was, you know, walking next to the ocean. She drowns herself in the ocean because she has terminal cancer and she can't watch her family suffer anymore, and she's about to die, so she just like drowns herself. And I actually got lost because I walked for so long, I walked so far away from my parents that I couldn't find them again when I turned around, and they had to get a search party. It was a big deal, actually. I thought I was never gonna see my parents again.
So you write your magazine features in your head, that's what you're telling me?
I write the pieces of them. Yeah, I actually never asked anybody else how they do it, so I don't know if that's not normal, but I do write the pieces in my head before. Like, I write my lead in my head.
Yeah.
Like, my entire lead exists sentence by sentence and word for word in my brain as a memorized chunk before I sit down to write it. Same with the ending.
Right.
And
when you sit down that first time, do you know the beginning and the end?
Yeah. Yes. I only started a story... It's not very often that I start stories and I don't know how they're going to end. I did... the Uganda feature that I did, actually, I wasn't totally sure where that was going to end when I sat down. When I say how it's going to end, I mean the sentence. I know the actual sentence.
And if
I don't know the actual sentence, like, I'm lost. And so the Uganda piece was actually really hard to write because I couldn't figure out what the sentence was that it ended on.
So do you remember the first time that you took one of those stories out of your head and put it down on paper?
Yeah, you know, in the Catholic school that I went to, we had to write a book every year.
Really?
Yeah. which now that I'm saying that out loud does sound really weird. So it makes sense that you made that face.
Who hugely ambitious.
Who does that? Well, I mean, you're six, so it doesn't have to be, you know.
I mean, it doesn't have to be a good book.
Well, it doesn't have to be super, super long, but we had to write a book every year. I still have some of them. And the first one that I can remember was about a girl. Actually, the very first one that I ever wrote, and it is hand-bound and on my bookshelf over there, is called Fox and His Friends. And it's about a fox that makes friends with a mouse named Sam. I illustrated it.
Terminal cancer?
As well. No! Nobody dies, and actually, they make friends with some other critter. I can't remember what kind of critter it is. And at first, they're a little wary, but then they decide to just all be besties, and it was really uplifting. And
that's so nice.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like you're in a good place then.
Yeah. Do you know why I was thinking about the girl drowning herself in my morbid defense? Is that my grandmother, my dad's mother, had recently told me, I don't know why, we were just like sitting at her kitchen table visiting, and she was like, drowning is supposed to be the most beautiful way to die. And I was like...
That's what your grandma told you when you were five?
That's what my grandma told me. So that's what I was thinking about. She said that when you drown, people, they say that when people drown, they see really beautiful colors. I never fact-checked that, because... I was five, and so I just took her word for it. So I was thinking about her saying that when I was walking, and so then I was trying to build a story around, like, why a five-year-old girl, which would be the only person I could relate to at that time as a five-year-old girl, would drown herself, and obviously it was terminal cancer.
I mean, it had to be. That's amazing that you remember that so vividly.
Yeah, no, you could totally call my grandma. I think awful. So, man. I can picture her. She's smoking cigarettes, and she's like, drowning is the most beautiful way to die. And I was like...
I can see how that could make an impression.
Can I have some more cantaloupe?
No. When did you know you wanted to write a book?
When I was in Thailand. I didn't go there to write about it. I went to Thailand to learn more about this refugee crisis that I'd stumbled upon on the internet and was just totally fascinated by and couldn't find any good information about it. And I just felt like I had to go. And I had just graduated from grad school, uh-huh. So, you know, like...
Where'd you go to grad school?
What was I doing? University of New Orleans.
Oh, wow.
Which is why I have Katrina issues about furniture.
Right.
Because I was there in 2005 during the hurricane. Anyway, so I went to Thailand, and I lived with these refugees from Burma who, you know, were on the business end of a genocide by the junta. They're this... this pretty small ethnic minority, and they had fled to Thailand, and they were just the most amazing, the people that I was with. They were, like, in their 20s, and they were dudes, and they were drunk a lot of the time, and hot, and really funny, and then they would just, like, run back into Burma and take pictures and interview people who'd been tortured and shit like that, and then sneak back into Thailand. Everything they were doing was totally illegal. And then sometimes they would get shot at and they would sneak back into Thailand. And then they would just load all this stuff into human rights databases in case anyone ever presses charges against the Burmese government for anything that they've ever done. And that was their job. And I was like, how is this a thing that nobody's ever heard about? Nobody knows about that civil war. A little bit more people do now because Burma's been in the news lately. They've had some big changes and stuff. But, you know, nobody knew what was going on. And I thought it was such a good story. And... they had such an amazing culture, these people that I was with, and I was like, I have to write a book. So it wasn't like, I would like to write a book. What would I like to write a book about? You know, and then I brainstormed. It was like, this book, it was like my baby, and I had to give birth to it in some form or another, so I applied for an internship.
Let's go back for a second. How did you land in Burma? Why did you go there? Was it really... like, you just had an itch you had to scratch about what was happening there?
Yeah, that is really, like, the whole
was it something
lame
you, like,
story.
It's not lame. Was it something that you, like, how long did you plan it for? Was it, like, you know, you were, like, Googling about Burma?
Yeah, this is, this story starts with Google. And in 2004, I went to Thailand because I just went overseas for 6 months and did a lot of traveling and things like that, but... when I was going to Thailand that time, some random Google search had turned me up, like deep into this Google search, had turned me up on this tiny little, you know, blurb about refugee camps, these refugee camps. And there were, you know, there's more than 100,000 refugees from Burma in these camps in Thailand. I was like, what? what? You know, it just, I'd never heard of it before, and I didn't really understand what was going on, and I wasn't as good at research and fact-checking then as I am now, and I couldn't really find any good information about it, so I just, like, planned a trip to go. That's it. That's really it. That's the whole story.
And so, and then you show up.
Mm-hmm.
And you get taken.
And they volunteer. Yeah, I volunteer with an organization.
Right.
That won't really say what they do for security purposes. And they give me a ride to this house and just drop me in it. And it's got, like, 20, 24-year-old refugee dudes living in it. Hiding in it, more accurately. And they're like, this is your home now. And I was like, that's great. Thanks.
And you were there for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And were, like, white gals from America coming over and living in this house a lot? Was that, like, a unique thing?
Not in the house. They did have volunteers, not necessarily American volunteers. They had had them before, but Norwegians were involved a lot somehow in this. I'm not really sure how. But funding or something, I don't know. But they had a steady stream of white gals. They didn't live in the house. I didn't find that out until almost it was time to go. They were like, usually our volunteers don't actually live in our house, you know? They, like, rent themselves their own house or, like, a hotel down the street. And I was like, oh, really? My bad. But it was good that I was there because, you know, I didn't miss anything. That probably is why I end up, you know, I lived with my sources in Ohio last year for this feature I was writing. I lived in their house for a month. And so I think that, and when I tell other reporters that, they're like, what? And I'm like, I wonder if that, you know, really influenced the way that the level to which I felt I needed to be immersed and stuff in the future.
Both of those stories are intensely personal. I mean, they're about these really large issues, but the way that you tell them is entirely kind of through your own experience. Just super creative nonfiction grad school style.
I know, right? Is that why I can't stop talking about myself, do you think? That's a complaint, you know? That's a complaint that I get. Some people, I think you sort of either love that or you hate it. Like, you feel like, yes, I feel really engaged with this narrator or this totally weird issue. Because nobody gives a shit about some far-flung genocide, about people they can't picture and things like that. So some people are like, this is helpful for me to have sort of an anchor that I can relate to a little bit better, you know? And whatever, and then some people are like, oh my god, would you please stop talking about yourself? we're talking about genocide, for fuck's sake. Like, enough about you. So I think it depends if you like that or don't like that.
Have you tried doing those, have you thought about doing those stories without putting yourself in them?
I sort of, you know, it's not a device. Like, it's not a scheme that I have. So when I write a story, I have the beginning and I have the end. But at some point when I need to figure out, you know, my stories are really long. So at some point when I need to figure out what's going to be in the middle, I will write down, you know, a marker of the beginning and a marker of the end and write out an outline, mm-hmm. you know, like you were taught to in second grade. I'm like, where is this going? Okay, it goes here and then it goes here and then it goes here. In those pieces when I'm doing those outlines, there's never, you know, any point where I'm like, insert self and story about childhood here, you know, that is not a thing. It's always about the events, but then as I start talking about the events when I'm actually writing it out, it's like my reactions. A lot of my, you know, the things about me in those stories is my reactions to the people who I'm talking to. Yeah. So it'll, as I'm writing them out, I remember how I felt about that kind of stuff, and then I just start blathering about it. And
well, I mean, in the Burma piece in particular, like, nobody knows about that.
No.
No one really understands how that, what the fuck is going on.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's a lot of you in there that's not directly related to this, but, like, it feels to me like having yourself in there allows, like, lets people off the hook for not getting it. You know what I mean? In a way that, like, you can't, when you read those stories about Burma in the Times,
mm-hmm.
like, There's a level of knowledge assumed.
Sure.
You know? But then there are other stories where like the going to work in the, what is it, Amalgamated? Is that the...
That is the pseudonym that we picked, yeah.
It's a good one.
Thank you.
that's a little bit different. I mean, that's not, there's not like a baseline of knowledge that needs to get acquired there. That's you trying to sort of like get across an experience by going through it yourself.
Sure. Right. That was actually about me. It was right. about my experience as a worker. Right. So I was, the premise was based on what my experience was. And so I could blather on myself all I wanted. But when you, yeah, the thing about Burma, I mean, if you pretend, unless you've been studying Burma for a long time or you live in Burma or, you know, were the bureau chief of some Thai newspaper office or something, you didn't know what was going on before you started writing that story. Right. And so, like, the things about me in those stories, it feels a little bit disingenuous to not have them in there because I didn't know what was going on either. And so I admitted that I didn't know what was going on. So basically, I was learning at the same time that the readers were learning what the deal was, right? And actually, so that, you know, that piece was nominated for a National Magazine Award. And at the National Magazine Award ceremony, they give, you know, they put a picture of the spread of the story up on the screen, and then someone reads some intro to it or like a quick summary. And like the summary was about how naive I was. They were like, in this piece, McClellan admits that she has no idea what's going on and has no skills as a reporter, or, you know, something like, I'm exaggerating, obviously, but it was something like that. That was what their summary was about. And I was like, you guys, it's 10,000 words long. And I pulled out some mad expertise in the end of that thing, but the only thing that they mentioned was that I was totally clueless about what was going on in Burma when I got there.
Amazing story by someone who doesn't understand this at all.
Basically.
The greatest right around of all time.
That is amazing.
Sorry about that. That's fucked up.
It's okay.
So you were there for 6 weeks, and I take it you knew you were going to write a book about it pretty shortly after you got there. At least that comes through in the story.
Well, when I was, I felt like I needed to tell, you know, like everybody that I knew. Like, yeah. So sort of my plan, I was 26, I don't know, who knows what I was thinking. I was like, I'm gonna go home and I'm gonna, like, tell everybody what's going on. And I don't really know how, I guess I could have formed some sort of activist group or joined there are lobbyists, pro Burma lobbyists, you know, in D.C. I could have, like, flown to D.C. and become that kind of person, but I'm not that kind of person, and so this was sort of how it went. The guys, actually, the refugees kept, you know, they ask you all the time, not just me, people, they ask foreigners all the time, you know, are you going to tell, what we said? Are you going to tell everybody what I said about what's happening to me? And you're like, yeah, definitely. So what was I going to, I'm going to not do that? And I felt like it was a legitimately good story. It's not just like, you should read this because it's important and you should learn about it. It's actually, in my opinion, a good story.
Yeah, I mean, I think, but that's another part of it. I feel like that having yourself as the through line, it really diminishes the, like, medicine factor with that story. You know, like it doesn't read or feel. It is a good story, but it's a hard story. Like, it's a hard thing. There are parts of the story that are hard to read.
Yeah,
you know, and I think a lot of times when people, or certainly I don't need to make generalizations about other people. When I read stuff that's hard to read, like it makes it inaccessible in a way.
Sure.
You know, and I think that having yourself in there and like cracking jokes.
Yeah.
You know, it again, like it lets you, I don't know, lets you get at this thing that I think people have really struggle to get at, you know, struggle to wrap their heads around or even kind of like engage with, which is, I mean, my sense is kind of like that's sort of the issue with the thing is that people aren't really engaging with what's actually happening, and kind of there's a bunch of like really helpful vocabulary to sort of talk around it.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's sort of the point of my position. I'm the human rights reporter, right, quote unquote, that's my job. And the point when they, I'm the first one, you know, like this at Mother Jones. So when they sort of invented this position, they specifically wanted something that was accessible and not just like a brick of research or mm-hmm. something, you know, that only a grad student or only somebody who was writing a doctorate thesis about, you know, Africa or something would read. So they wanted something that was about things that you should know but are horrible and too horrible for you to know, but at the same time could be accessible in a way that normal people and not just doctoral students would read them. So that was, I think that was sort of the vision.
How do you get up, like, how do you get up in the morning when your job is to write about horrible things? Like, what, where's this, like, where's the sunshine in your life?
You know, I go to a lot of therapy, so yeah. That.
That's great. That sounds like happy times.
Well, you sort of, you look for the hope in some of, okay, so I don't know if I'm supposed to talk about this, but I'm going to talk about it right now anyway. So the story that I'm working on right now, that's due in a week, is about veterans, and it's about PTSD, and PTSD does shit to your, like, interpersonal relationships that you couldn't even imagine, right? Well, a lot of people can, because they have it, but if you're not that guy, you can't. And so a lot of, and this is horrible, like, I went to war, and I fought for my country, and I killed a bunch of people, and now I'm at home in my house in suburbia, and I can't stop thinking about killing people, and also I have brain damage, because I was in 47 IED blasts, and so I also can't remember stuff, and so I can't really tell when I'm having flashbacks if I'm really in Iraq, or if I'm actually in North Carolina, and, you know, whatever. So that's awful. it's really awful. And I am only, like, getting into the very surface of how awful it is. But this story that I'm writing is structured as a love story. It's totally a love story, like, from the beginning to the end of it and through the middle of it. And it is so depressing. And I think it will be a little bit hard to read without crying, but it is totally a love story. A love story is a thing that people can totally relate to. Mm-hmm. People cannot relate to soldiers if they're not soldiers.
Yes. Agreed.
That's a problem. But, I mean, they're people. Soldiers are people too, right? So they have the same issues. Everybody's issue is that they're trying to find how to get along in their families and with their partners, right? Like, uh-huh. It's the most universal theme in the world. And so the thing about PTSD is that it fucks with the most basic and central theme of most people's lives. And so it's the same struggle. It's just different. Mm-hmm. So that's how... I think that's how this one is going to be more accessible than...
That's how you get up in the morning?
With hope of a love story.
Yeah, I mean, it does a love story, is like a love story inherently
is helpful? It enough?
I mean, like, was your actual answer to that question that, like, you're trying to find some hope in these, like, deeply horrible things?
Or? My actual answer to this question was the first one that I gave you, which is that I go to a lot of therapy, and then also you do try to find hope in the stories that you do, like the Uganda story, like, it's about these gay activists, right, who could be murdered for being gay activists, and they know that can happen here too, and that does happen here too, so I'm not gonna act like, you know, that's just Uganda's problem and the United States doesn't have hate crimes, because we do, obviously, but there it's, you know, way more out of control and more police sanctioned, etc. So then we had these pictures of these guys, of this gay couple, these two guys who were, like, just going grocery shopping and going shopping for t-shirts and stuff together, like a couple, you know? And they were like, yes, we want your photographer to take a picture of this. Like, we know that this would be worth dying for. Like, this is a cause that we care about, and, you know, take our fucking picture looking at the label on a can of juice in a grocery store. And so we did, and we, you know, we ran these pictures, and there's a lot of strength and resilience even in the worst stories ever. I mean, you do get bogged down, definitely, or I do, by how much evil so many people are willing to perpetrate in the world, but I guess the little beam of sunshine that you're looking for that hits me in the face in the morning is the character of and the integrity of the people who are involved.
I assume there's ought to be, you've got to take some solace from trying to expose it too. I mean, writing about these things that don't get written about very much, and writing about them in a way that they certainly don't get written about very much, you got to get some strength there too, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, I do think, and that sounds so lame. I'm like, it's really important. I feel like it's important. You know, it's
you're a human rights reporter. You're allowed to say that.
It's my conviction. I do feel like it's really important. So yeah. Yes, I am definitely motivated by, and it's also, there's something also sort of obnoxious about that. Like, I have so much conviction that I have to go do whatever. But I mean, you're right. It is like, I'm very motivated by my conviction about these things.
How do you pick, when your beat is like everything fucked up in the world, how do you find stories? How do you pick how do you find the next fucked up thing you're gonna go write about?
Sometimes they find you, you know, like when I ended up in the Gulf in the United States Gulf for 4 months covering the oil spill because I happened to be there covering some other story about the public defender's office in New Orleans when Deepwater Horizon blew up and started like spewing oil all over the place. So that happened. And then I was just there.
Yeah.
And then I stayed because it ended up being this enormous catastrophe, obviously. While I was there, I met one of the cleanup workers who I met was this Indian who was from Oklahoma. In this, he didn't actually live on the reservation. The reservation areas in Oklahoma are like patchy. They're very like broken up, not like in Oregon or something where there's huge, or Washington where there's huge pieces of them. So, and he was like, I beat people up for money because there's no law on reservations. And I was like, what's that? So, you know, then I met that guy in a bar.
Yeah.
So that, you know, so then I ended up doing that. And it just sort of, so yeah, sometimes they just sort of come to you, and then you pitch them, and then your editors either like them or they don't. It's not very often that I've pitched something that Monica and Claire, my editors, have been like, that is a terrible idea. But it has happened before, mm-hmm. where I'm like, here's this awful thing, and they're like, you know what, that's just an awful thing. Can you elevate
it? Not awful enough.
Well, not that, just that it's just like, there was no other angle except for, this is awful. And they were like, okay, there's lots of things that are awful, and you have to have something.
They still need to be good stories.
Yeah, you have to have something else, not just, this is so awful. So, and I did pitch one story like that, and they were like, nope. So then I moved on, and
Speaking of moving on, I want to go back to the Deepwater Horizon thing for a second, because I feel like everyone forgot about that shit.
You mean while it was happening, or today?
Today.
Yeah.
Like,
well, people, don't say everyone, not people in Louisiana or Florida. They are definitely, it's still in their newspaper all the time.
Mm. What's happening there now?
Well, as much as their newspaper exists, you know, the Times Pick, New Orleans newspaper just fired whatever percentage of their staff. But their coverage was amazing, was amazing when it was happening. And it was on the front page, you know, and half the paper every single day and continue. I haven't been to New Orleans in a couple months, but I was just there a couple months ago, and it's still, related stuff is still in the paper, you know, when they find big die-offs, and they're still, you know, digging at the, what scientists are being funded by who, and all that kind of stuff, and who knew what when, and everything, they're not giving it up, because it's, you know, it's obviously really important to them, but what happened is a lot of people lost a bunch of money, and that's,
well, I mean, it was one of those stories that I thought was gonna leave more of a mark, I guess. Like, you know, like in the way that like Katrina did. You know, like everyone has like a point of reference.
Or even the Exxon Valdez.
Yeah, absolutely. Even, like that. Which, I mean, that was, you know, what, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And that or 25 or whatever. But that, you know, that still has this touch on that. I feel like I can't quite figure out why Deepwater hasn't had that level of resonance, but maybe it's just like a region can only have so many disasters.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's like
people have Gulf Coast fatigue.
Yeah, you've got like a bank account, and you can get cashed out with your disasters or something.
Or it's a product of the difference in the way the news cycle works now.
Yeah, for sure.
No story is that big of a story, really, for, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I guess
so,
it's
long,
like,
of a time.
Because it just gets the shit beaten out of it, and then it's gone, you know.
Right, and then you're like, enough of that already.
Tell me about changing your byline.
About changing my byline?
Weren't you Nicole?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, nobody calls me that.
And no one's ever called you that.
No, actually, nobody has ever called me that, because my mom especially called me Nick,
mm-hmm.
and so does my sister. And since grad school, and that's what a lot of people call me, and then when I was really little, and then maybe through high school, a lot of people call me Nikki, which my parents gave me when I was really little, which is terrible. No offense to anybody who's like listening to this and was like, my name is Nikki and I love it. I'm really happy for those people.
Nikki would not sue.
Hate it. No, you're right. You're sitting next to me and you can see that that is not appropriate.
No,
and I don't know why my parents... Also, my middle name is Brianna. So my parents just like were... I don't know. You know, they smoke a lot of pot and whatever. So I have a great big fat grandpa. I mean, he's dead now. But I have a great big fat grandpa. Southern, you know, black suits with purple shirts unbuttoned and chest hair and gold chains, and his name's Mac, and everybody called him Mac, you know, this
yeah.
my grandpa Mac, and that's, you know, that was my nickname. And so I changed my, but because you're associated, once you actually start writing, you know, you're associated, your byline and your what people call you in real life becomes the same thing,
right?
So it just, all my friends already call me that, and I was using what was on my birth certificate, even though it was not really my name anymore, so I changed it.
But there's also, I mean, there's another element of going by Mac, right, which is that people probably assume you're a dude a lot.
Yeah, well, that wasn't something I was going for.
Right.
I mean, it does happen occasionally, but not that often,
really?
Actually. No, because...
I guess if you read the first line of most of your stories, it's pretty clear.
Right, or the internet. You know, like, there's pictures of your face next to all the stuff
right.
that you do a lot now, and if somebody Googled you, like, you know, your picture would come up and stuff like that, so it doesn't happen that often to me that people confuse me for a dude. And I wasn't really, and even if they did, like, I don't care. So, that somebody brought that up to me when I was changing my byline as a thing that maybe I should be concerned about, but I was like, who cares?
Yeah.
And also, it really doesn't happen.
It hasn't happened.
It is very... Maybe it's happened, like, 3 times.
So it was more about just kind of, like, getting to... getting closer to, like, what you're actually calling.
Yeah, yeah, so, I mean, otherwise, you would be...
I would have been calling you Nikki all day.
Right, and I would, because, you know, nobody that I know in my... Nobody I hang around with calls me that. I would feel like you were talking to somebody else, you know, and you were not talking to me. And then I would be like, no, I know what my byline says, but despite that, call me something totally different. And that just seems like a pain in the ass.
Totally.
So, right?
Yeah.
It's like, despite what it says there.
So how long were you fact-checking? You went to Burma before you got the job fact-checking at Mother Jones.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
How long were you fact-checking for before you inaugurated the human rights reporter position?
I was a fact-checker for 4 months, and then I was hired as...
For the record here, I can't remember if we were recording when this was on before, but you were talking all kinds of shit about how you had learned, like, the ins and outs of all fact-checking. You were only a fact-checker for 4 months?
I know a lot about... How long... Have you ever been a fact-checker?
No, but I wasn't claiming to know...
Well, so what do you know?
I just wasn't claiming to know everything about it. Most people I know have done that job did it for, like, 2 years.
You can know a lot about fact-checking in 4 months. That's... The reason I did it for 4 months is because that's how long our fact-checking internship cycle lasted at that time. Now it's 6 months.
Okay, but you're not
but
mad
it used to be... I'm really mad. It used to be 4 months. So I went through one cycle, and then you can... re-up as a fellow if you're
mm-hmm.
doing a good enough job. And obviously I was. So they offered me, I was going to stay on as a fellow, but then they needed a copy editor, it turned out, randomly, and I'm a grammar spaz. So they ended up hiring me for that, which is, you know, pays marginally, but still better than being an intern. So I became a person on the staff and then spent all my free time writing a book proposal and trying to get a book deal because I was nobody and it's really hard to do and things like that. So I think I was a copy editor for... This job started January 1 of 2010. So I was a copy editor for like 2 years. And while I was copy editor, I wrote a couple pieces for the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And just tried to get the whole book thing together. And then finally, you know, I had galleys in some, at some point in 2009, I had galleys and the deal and it was coming out and whatever. And I asked my editors if they wanted to read this book that I wrote, and they were like, sure, we'll look at it. And then they gave me a new job.
Do you always want to write about this stuff? I mean, do you, it's horrible, awful things going to be your
no.
beat forever?
No, I don't think so.
What would you like to write about?
What would I like to write about? Well, that's partly, I'm drawn to things like that. And, you know, when I get involved in some sort of, I read something about some story that I feel like isn't being told enough, and then I'm like, well, I have to go write, and it's usually something horrible. But so
have you
I
had that urge with anything that wasn't horrible?
Not lately, but you know, it's partly once you're in it, that's sort of where your brain lives. You know, that's sort of like it's sort of like the things that I'm looking for and the things that I'm immersed in now. So I definitely need to branch out a little bit, you know. It's not, and my job at the magazine is still, my beat is the same, and as long as that's my beat, that is the kind of stuff that I'm gonna, you know, that I'm gonna write about that you keep calling horrible. But
sorry, is there like a better term I can
no
use?
You're right, it's horrible.
So there are a couple other stories I wanted to ask about. One was the warehouse story.
Mm-hmm.
And for anyone who's listening who hasn't read it, you went and worked in, like, if it wasn't an Amazon shipping place, it was an Amazon-like shipping place.
Right.
Which was this massive, massive warehouse in a nameless state. I made me never want to order anything off the internet ever again.
See, that's what we were going for.
And
right.
Do you order anything off the internet?
I did order something off the internet. It was a hamper that you put your dirty clothes in after I had already done that story. Well, because I was trying to figure out where I would get a hamper. Is that a regional thing? Do only people from Ohio call those hampers?
No, those are hampers.
Okay. So I was looking for... people tell me that most people don't say pop, so sometimes I'm never sure.
Yeah, I mean,
about...
you know pop is a regional thing.
I know that now. Because
you didn't know that?
No, they don't teach you that in Ohio. Like, this is what we call it.
Don't say
like,
this
don't
shit
say
when
that
you
to other people. No, they don't say that. So I thought maybe hampers was something. Anyway, so I needed a hamper, and I buy, you know, I very dutifully and happily, because my grocery store is adorable. You should check it out when you leave if you want, but it's wildly expensive and, you know, small and family owned. And I buy all my groceries there, and I, you know, I go to the bookstore, and I do things like that. And the point of the story was not, you should stop shopping on the internet, because that is not going to happen. Nobody is going to destroy the online
shopping on the internet.
Shipping.
It's awesome.
It is the best thing ever.
Yeah.
You don't have to do anything. It's so easy. And when you can't find a hamper, I don't have a locally owned hamper store in my neighborhood, or as far as I could find within like 5 neighborhoods of here. So I was like, fuck it. I just ordered off the internet. Like, what choice do I have? Where am I going to get a hamper? I was even, because I was like, I could just use a bucket. I was like, oh my God, I'm just ordering a hamper.
I could just go to the bucket store and get a bucket.
Well, the point of the story, you know, was not boycott shopping on the internet, because that's not reasonable. Nobody is going to do that. People are going to order stuff off the internet. The
they
point
just
is...
feel shame while they do.
Well, no, the point is that the people who run those companies, they really don't have to do it like that. They make so much money that's not necessary for it to be torture for the people who work there. So the point is, you know, the more people know you're torturing people, the more you might have to stop torturing people at some point. So, I mean, that was the point of the story. I have no illusions that, you know, people are going to stop shopping on the internet. That's not the goal. The goal is for the people who are running those companies to stop being such assholes.
Right.
Needlessly. Because they have so much money that they, you know, you don't have to be that much of an asshole. Just be less of an asshole. That's all I'm asking.
Yeah, I mean, they could be a fraction less asshole-ish. And it sounds like life in those factors would be...
It could make
factors,
a big, could make a big difference. Warehouse,
a
yeah, it could make a big difference. And that would make a really big difference to people who spend 80 hours a week there. You know? Like, come on.
So between these stories, like, do you give yourself time off to, like, decompress a little bit?
I do, yeah. I do now. I didn't used to, and then I paid for it dearly. So now...
How'd you pay for it?
I mean, I have PTSD. It's pretty bad. And so some days I can't. So, I mean, to answer your question, like, how do you get out of bed? Some days I can't.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends on the day. And I have good days and bad days. But, yeah, now I definitely take longer periods between stuff than I used to. So that I have lots of time to process and sort of move through whatever. Or I turn things... I turn down... a story for, I don't know if I'm supposed to say, because maybe they assigned it to somebody else. So this pretty fancy magazine called me and they were like, do you want to go to Iraq? And I was like, no, I don't. Because at this point, like, it's...
Is this after you started working on the soldier story?
This was like 2 months ago.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, because I have like a long list of like, and a big stack of pictures of horror right in my brain.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, the thing about when you have PTSD is like one of the bigger problems, adjustment problems that you have is that you're hypervigilant when you shouldn't be. So, you know, we could be sitting on a couch and my body is totally convinced that I'm about to get murdered. And like, people hear that, they're like, oh, you're a vet, you have PTSD and you're hypervigilant. But it doesn't really mean anything to most people what it really feels like to be hypervigilant, and it's awful. So like, if you were in a house and there was a murderer in it and you knew it, like, and it was dark and there were no lights and you had to sort of like make your way around this house, like, think about what your nervous system would feel like. Like, that, you know, sometimes if you get startled in the middle of the night, it's that sort of thing. If you felt like that for hours and hours at a time, for no reason, I mean, it's exhausting and it's awful. So that's what it's like, and that's a thing that happens. So it's hard to unlearn once you've sort of gotten into it. It's really hard to unlearn, and so that you can just, like, be a person who's calm and sitting on a couch, and that won't just, like, come over you with, like, no notice or whatever. I'm fine right now.
You seem like you're doing all right.
BTW. Oh, yeah. I'm great. But the point is, I don't need to go to Iraq right now.
Mm-hmm.
In conclusion, it's not the best time for me to go. And so I told them, I was like, you know, I don't think this is a good idea. And they were like, well, it's not like the super war zone-y part. And I was like, what part is it?
Yeah.
It's like the vacation part. Yeah, I mean, where...
You're going to that Iraq beach.
People are just like, right, hanging out. And there's like a lot of clubs or whatever. So, and also it was, I'm not totally sure, but I think the story had something to do with spending a lot of time with people who've been like horribly tortured or something. And I was like, you know what? I'm not up for it. And 2 years ago, I never would have said that. If anybody would have given me any horrible thing, I'd have been like, yes, I'm on a plane, like, tomorrow. But, you know, I think I have learned a lot more about my limits now. And so I was like, I'm sorry, I can't.
Well, I guess maybe that's like, I know I asked you this already, but maybe this is actually what I was trying to ask, is like, you know, can you safely keep writing these stories forever and ever? Like, is that
right, like what's the limit?
Yeah, is there like, do you have like a, can you run out of what it must take, like what you must go through to write these stories? Can you like run out of whatever that is?
You can, and people do all the time. That's, and you'll hear that from, I'm really not old enough to talk like this, right? I'm 32. But you'll hear that from older reporters who will be like, yeah, sure, in my youth, yes, I would have done this, this, and this story, and I did that, that, and that, and I can't do that anymore. There is definitely a limit to what you can do. And that's sort of the million-dollar question. Like, I don't, you know, you don't know, you sort of have to test
right
where the limits are. And
did you agonize at all over whether or not to let Anne Friedman published that piece in Good?
Well, you say let, like she was trying to convince me, and I was reluctant, but then I gave in. But that's, of course, not how it happened. I pitched that story to her. So, sort of. We just were sort of talking about it, because I know her, and I was like, here's this thing. Yes, I knew that that was not going to go well. I am surprised at how well it didn't go. Like, I mean, I knew it was going to be bad, but I knew it was going to be that bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. As a person who does a lot of horrible things, you know, I have like, I'm like, this will probably be horrible. But it was, even to me, the level of horrible was surprising.
For anyone who's listening who hasn't read that, can you just kind of like give the brief synopsis? Because I'm not going to try.
Yeah, sure. So when you have one of the first things to go for a lot of trauma victims is a normal sex life, basically. But it's the last thing anybody ever talks about, right? So nobody would ever, soldiers certainly, are not going to be like, you know what my problem is? Intimacy. I can't. And I'm having a hard time emotionally connecting when I have intercourse. You know, nobody wants to talk about that. Yeah. So even sexual abuse victims who sort of are the ones who get studied for it the most because it seems like the most obvious connection to people, even though any kind of PTSD, car accidents, even like war, all kinds of stuff, fucks up your sex life. Not everybody's, but a lot of people. So, mine included. And so I basically, I wrote an essay about it.
How did it go so bad? Like, what was so bad?
Well, I had somehow not anticipated so many, and I shouldn't say so many, because, you know, when one person, do people ever write really mean things about you on the internet for any reason?
Yeah, it's happened, I guess.
Okay. Like, even when one person does that, it seems so loud.
It's so loud. Yeah.
Right. So when I say everybody, I'm talking about like three people.
Yeah.
Like, I'm talking about a blogger or two bloggers or, you know, whatever, but who happened to write for prominent sites in some cases. Like, you know, so I hadn't anticipated that anyone would say, and I don't know why, because I know better, but that my problem was that I was a whiny white bitch, and truly, I'm just afraid of black men. And, like, this whole issue is not, the case is not that trauma victims have intimacy issues. The case is that I am the world's biggest racist. Like, I really somehow had not anticipated anybody saying that. Or, you know, the only reason I was doing this was for glory or something, as though I would, you know, spend my time and my energy writing about violence against poor black women in another country in order to be famous, because that's an issue that anybody gives a shit about, you know, like...
Right, yeah, well, I mean, that's been the route to... worldwide fortune fame for many people.
Right. I have so much money now because I tried to expose that issue. So it was, you know, I felt like I was, I mean, I know that I'm not a bad person and my intentions are good. My intentions, you know, I had pretty serious intentions actually about exposing this rape problem that these people were having. So, you know, going in with that and then the way that it can affect, you know, just the way that it can affect other, you know, people around, and just the way that trauma affects intimacy and things like that is just like, I mean, I think it's a really, really important issue. And yeah. I knew that some people were going to be like, whore, and that did happen. Right. But then somehow I had not anticipated so many people saying that I was a racist. I don't know.
Yeah,
whatever.
Fuck those assholes. But what was the reaction on the other end? Did you hear from people who that rang true with?
Sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, part of the reason why I was like, you know why I need to write this is because you can't find anything about it. There are only very, very specific niche, you know, publications, and you have to be really looking hard to find people who are talking about not being able to have sex or what happens when you have sex, because the stuff that happens when you have sex if you have PTSD is like fucking crazy sometimes. Like, seriously, you could have imagine if you were inside somebody and then you had a flashback and you thought you were in a different country. It's very disconcerting for all partners.
Yeah, for
so
everyone.
Everybody is disconcerted. Your cat, like, everybody is totally freaked out when that happens. And that is, it's a thing, and it happens to a lot of people. And so, yeah, I got like 9,000 emails from people who were like, oh my God. And, you know, the ironic thing about this is that everybody that happens to thinks they're the only person.
Right.
Most, you know, poignantly, at the moment, we have 500,000 vets, right, who just got back from war. A lot of them are in their 20s, and they have wives, and they come back to wives, and they try to have sex with them, and shit goes horribly wrong, but, like, nobody will talk about this. So, one of my sources, actually, for the story that I'm working on right now, he was one of the people who emailed me in the aftermath of that story and was like, you know, he was a Marine, so he was like, Semper Fi, dude, keep your head up, people just don't understand, but I hear you, like, I can't touch... my wife, and you know, it just, and you can't talk about it in the group therapy that the VA gives you. You know, you get a bunch of Marines in a room and they're not going to talk about it.
I've been in those rooms. It's impossible to imagine that conversation happening there.
Yeah. It's just like, it wouldn't happen. And it ruins when you're, you know, when your family relationship, it can ruin your relationships if you don't know how to talk about it. And if you feel like you're like, well, I'm the only person this is happening to. So obviously I'm insane and it's just me and you don't want to tell anyone. And the level of shame is so incredibly high. And so, yeah, I got a lot of emails from people like that. And that guy in particular, you know, they were having all these marriage problems, and that happens a lot. And then people end up getting divorced. And according to the VA's own congressional testimony, by and large, the reason that we're seeing all these suicides, most of the suicides of the soldiers, which if you've been reading the stats about those lately are just like off the charts, are immediately preceded by breakups.
Really?
Yeah. And this guy, this source of mine, actually, this Marine, he killed himself like a couple months into our correspondence, like an hour after the last email that he wrote me.
Holy shit.
So I stand by that it's an important issue. It's a bigger issue than people. And it's not just like vets. It's like people with all kinds of like trauma backgrounds and stuff like that.
How did you find out that he killed himself?
His wife emailed me, actually, and she said, you know, I'm not actually positive what state of separation they were in at that point, but she emailed me and she said that, you know, it came from his email address. So I got this email from him and I was like, oh, hey, I got an email from that guy. So I opened it and it was like, hey, this is actually that guy's wife. And I know that he'd been talking to you and I know that was really helpful for him. So thank you for that. But he's dead. And I check his email sometimes. And I just wanted to send you a note and let you know. So that's how I found out. And then I Googled it. And
you were working on the story that you're still working on. You had already started that one.
Yeah, I was definitely gathering. I wasn't memorizing chunks of it in my head yet, but I was gathering a lot of string, so.
And now you've got the beginning and you've got the end in your head?
Yeah, and I'm like halfway through the middle.
Amazing.
So, yes, I'm doing awesome work on that.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading it. That seems like a pretty natural place to stop, so.
Really? On
how much I'm looking forward to reading your story.
Okay.
Which is going to be awful and gut-wrenching.
Right, but it's going to be a love story.
And there will be Mac McClellan jokes, so it'll be good.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I hope you like it.
Thanks for listening to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I host this thing with Evan Ratliff of The Atavist and Aaron Lammer of Longform. Our editor is Lauren Kirchner. Thanks to Mac McClellan for taking the time and for giving me whiskey before my red eye back to New York. If you want to read any of the stories that Mac and I talked about, they're all in the show notes. Longformpodcast.tumblr.com. If you want something entirely different, check out the new story from The Atavist at atavist.com. See you next week. Let these times that you're breaking up. Leaving all your dreams too far behind. Didn't you see? You can't make it without ever even trying. And something's on your mind.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys.
You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.